Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show Live. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Anlu Kiva. Anlu, you look cold.
I'm considerably colder than I used to be when I was on a couple of weeks ago. So I don't know what happened in Cape Town, but I am exceptionally cold today.
I believe this thing called winter has been afflicted upon us. Now, me personally, I actually really like winter, and I like the Cape's winter in particular. It's one of the reasons why I moved here. But I know this is not a popular view amongst most South Africans who are, shall we say, not super keen on the cold. But anyway, let us get into what's going on today. And I guess we have to talk about what is probably the biggest story in the country right now, and that is the soccer. So this was a number of former South African football stars who were legends were in the in studios, on TV, and this was their live reaction to our 2-0 defeat to Mexico last night.
Okay, what do we say? What do we say? What went wrong this game?
So for those listening on audio only, the camera just zooms in on their faces as they look sort of comfortable and distraught and smiling at the same time and just utter silence fills the room as to their feelings about how the game went. Not go well. I predicted yesterday we'd lose 0-1, but I hoped it would feel a little bit closer. What did it get? 2 red cards, and we lost 2-0. And it's just, you know, it would have been nice, you know, to have a win. But anyway, I didn't particularly expect a victory. But why are we talking about soccer? Well, apart from that, it was interesting to see on social media, unfortunately, an awful lot of the world seemed to be rooting against us. I saw lots of accounts from overseas cheering on Mexico. But what was more interesting was quite often during the World Cup, we've seen this sort of pan-African solidarity kind of thing going on where supporters of different African countries tend to back whoever the African team is in the World Cup. This was, you know, my most famous example of this, the one I remember best is when Ghana went against Uruguay in the quarterfinals in 2010 in the World Cup we hosted, and all the South African presenters in the TV studio were super excited to see Ghana win, and it looked like Ghana was going to win, and then there was that ridiculous handball, but let's not dig up old wounds. But this time things have changed a little bit. And unfortunately, this seems to be a result of the anti-foreigner sentiment in South Africa right now. So social media has been filled with all sorts of memes and videos like these ones. Here is one of a guy from Ghana declaring his enthusiastic support for Mexico.
Love that. Shout out to man gringo. Yes, gringo, ringo, wap, hey, mandingo. Oh yeah, make me tell it. We never see no bad man where we a car. Yes, you got.
And then here's this one of a guy, I think he's Nigerian or something in the US, but declaring his support for Mexico.
African? Why you supporting Mexico, bro? You African?
Sí, soy africano, pero today, hoy, soy mexicano, dale.
Nigga, you Nigerian.
Hey, listen. Compa.
Unfortunately, this is been very explicitly tied by many people on social media to some of the anti-immigration protests we've had recently. I saw one comment mocking us at our defeat in soccer, posting pictures of some of the leaders of the anti-immigration marches and saying you left your best attackers at home. That's why you didn't score any goals. And why does this matter? Well, this matters for two reasons. One is that I think for a long time in South Africa, and you see this particularly in the ANC and the EFF, Pan-Africanism has been a very important ideology, particularly during the Mbeki years, right? We had sort of African Renaissance was this whole theme that the Mbeki administration pushed. Julius Malema still is one of the last kind of defenders in that crowd of Pan-Africanism. But I think we can clearly say now that it's sort of mutually dead. I don't think many South Africans buy into Pan-Africanism in any sort of real way. And I think many Africans from the rest of the continent don't see South Africa as sort of kin, which is possibly a good thing. I think that Pan-Africanism has not been a very good ideology for the continent or for South Africa. That being said, this is also kind of sad to see other countries around the world sort of cheering on our defeat. This, you know, brings back some memories of, well, it's before my time, but some sort of historical memory of when we were the pariah of the world during apartheid. And it's not nice to see that kind of coming back. Also, Anlu, it seems like it's an erosion of our soft power.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of this?
Yeah, well, I have to agree with you that funny as these videos that come out of it is, it genuinely is sad to see. It's unfortunate how ironic it is that this whole orientation of the Mbeki era was towards a Pan-African orientation. And Mbeki almost thought that, well, we got the sense at least from the way that he opened the borders and had an open border policy that he almost felt he owed the rest of Africa something. And it's ironic how we are kind of at a historia.
Yeah, I think it was more than that. In some ways, I think Mbeki almost thought of himself as the president of Africa in some ways.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And it's ironic how we've kind of ended on the complete opposite side of that, where we've put such a big barrier between us, or we're at least busy putting such a big barrier between us and the rest of Africa, that even in small things like these, it kind of comes through. And in a sense, I'm saying small things, but I also know that these are the type of events that really tells the thoughts of South Africans and of Africans. These are the things in which we see how the rest of the continent genuinely feels about us. I get also the sense, well, I said this a couple of weeks ago, it feels like every time we discuss videos, there's immigration videos. And it is the case because it's obviously highly politicized at the moment. But over the past couple of weeks.
I think it's also something that's big on social media in particular.
Yes.
Perhaps above even its importance to ordinary South Africans sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. My feed is full of immigration related videos and foreign nationals being pushed out here and there and warnings going out and that type of thing. But over the past couple of weeks, I've genuinely gotten the sense that, well, what I said a couple of weeks ago when I was on and we discussed this issue was that I get the sense it's a pathological politics that's kind of at the play here. And over the past couple of weeks, that sentiment really was established for me. I genuinely get the sense that what is happening here is that we have our political parties and we have these movements like March and March and their leaders who find it more useful to exploit the problem than to solve it. And that is putting us in a very unfortunate position and a horrible position to be in respect to the rest of the continent as well. Many of these people would rather identify an enemy and use that enemy to explain why our South African people and people in South Africa are struggling and are suffering, because that's easier than actually identifying the problems. And in this sense, I think it's a pathological political problem. Because we see these politicians grabbing more power by pushing the problem away from not directing the fingers at themselves and saying that these are the problems. I mean, if you just briefly take an example of people in townships, well, you're looking for a job, you're looking at, let's say there's a spaza shop and there's competition for the spaza shop somewhere in the informal economy. The diagnosis that many of these movements give is that you can't get the job there because of foreigners taking the jobs. And that's not quite the problem. We even had Ramaphosa on many occasions pointing out that The problem is that we have local people also taking advantage of perhaps cheaper services that foreigners offer. But from that, you can kind of get the sense that the problem isn't the foreigners in South Africa. The problem is that there's all these labor regulations and these regulations across the entire economy that kind of puts a pressure on our local economy to not create enough opportunities and to not offer better services to people. And that puts the South Africans in a position where they're kind of looking for a scapegoat. And many of these movements and leaders are all too happy to point their finger to an enemy in this case, as they've pointed out, that is both reachable and identifiable. So yeah, I genuinely agree. It is sad and it's unfortunate and it's ironic. But you've also briefly mentioned the point that this is perhaps the one thing that is putting an end to the whole pan-African idea in South Africa, at least, which I don't know, that perhaps has its benefits with it. But yeah, it is unfortunate that the rest of Africa is starting to look at us as this distant and almost enemy to the rest of the continent, which we definitely are not.
There was a meme that I saw, which was a picture. It was a picture of Africa, and the whole of Africa was colored in with the Mexican flag, except South Africa, which had the South African flag coloring in its borders. And that kind of was the sort of sentiment yesterday, unfortunately. Yeah, you know, South Africa has this sort of complicated relationship, I think, with the rest of the continent, in the sense that we've always, I think, held ourselves up as being kind of a little bit better than the rest of Africa, or maybe its leader or something like that. And that's always, I think, created a bit of resentment. That's I think it's really hurting us now, when we don't have the sort of military, economic, and diplomatic ability to kind of back up those pretensions of grandeur that the South African state has on the African continent. That being said, on the subject of Pan-Africanism, you know, there's a lot of different forms of Pan-Africanism. You could see it as essentially a sort of an ideology which just seeks to take this region, which has a kind of a similar-ish history, and integrate people and allow trade and all these sort of things and encourage peace, all that sort of stuff. But that's unfortunately not how Pan-Africanism is usually expressed. Pan-African is often an explicitly racial ideology that sees Black people as a single nation, as the central force of political movement, and that Africa should be one country or one racial group, and that anyone who is not Black African should be basically kicked out. And you've seen this enacted across the continent in various places. I mean, one of the most infamous being Idi Amin's expulsion of Indian Ugandans in the 70s. But anyway, so yeah, I think while that ideology definitely did have some real play in the kind of post-independence 60s and 70s, one of the biggest anti-apartheid movements in South Africa was, of course, the Pan-Africanist Congress during the 50s and 60s. I think now that we can say that Pan-Africanism really is on life support as an ideology. And considering its track record in Africa and South Africa, I would say, you know, I'm not going to shed too many tears over that change. Anyway, final thoughts from you.
Yeah, I think it's also worth raising the point that we need to make sure that we have a consistent and healthy relationship with the rest of the continent for various economic reasons as well. We have this wonderfully diverse continent at our disposal, basically, that we can interact with and trade with and have an exchange of skills and culture. And there's this wonderful relationship that has also formed from the various countries on the continent. And it's important for us to continue our trade relationship with our neighbors. It's important for us to continue this exchange of skills that we have with our neighbors. And I think there are many foreigners that come to South Africa and many South Africans that go to foreign countries to work there and to contribute to the economy and to genuinely be contributing effective members of societies. I think there is a strong argument to be made for people integrating in the country that you are in. I think that is important. But I get the sense that that's not even the issue that they are kind of addressing here. The issue is rather pointing the finger and identifying foreigners in the country as enemies. So, y'all, we'll see how it plays also out closer to the end of the month and see what happens to the tensions in that aspect. But, let's see how it plays out for now.
Yeah, I think I'm correct in saying that if you looked at other African countries, that is actually our biggest trade market. It's other African countries, then the EU as a bloc, then China, then the US, and then I'm not sure who's next. I think it's India. So obviously this is not going to go anywhere anytime soon. I think we're only going to see more of this in the lead up to the local government elections. But let's move on to our next story, which is talking a little bit about corruption and the culture of corruption. Now, the DA Minister of Home Affairs, Leon Schreiber, who has actually been sort of really tangled up in a lot of this immigration stuff because of, Home Affairs' important role in documenting people who come here legally and illegally. The department is trying to convince other officials to change the entire culture of corruption in Home Affairs, which we know is a huge problem. And one of the ways they've done this is they've taken someone who was convicted of corruption at Home Affairs, and she's giving speeches to officials explaining basically how corruption destroyed her life. So let's listen to that.
Although my career cannot be restored, SARS was teaching me I would go to any university that I want. They would pay you for all my education. Now all that was taken away from me. My pension was taken away from me. My houses, my cars, it was all taken away from me just because of one selfish act. Then I had to pay everything. There's also a unit that is called Asset Forfeiture Unit. They have not spoken about it yet. That unit, it will make sure that you lose everything that you have. They will collect up to the last cent that you have corrupted or you have frauded. The same has happened in my life. Today, when I get out of correctional services, I just have a simple plan of maybe baking biscuits just to make a living, of which is totally different from where I was before incarceration. So this is not to make you scared, but it is to caution you of what corruption and fraud is like in South Africa and what impact it has in our country.
So, Anlu, interesting approach to try and sort of bring people on board with just how devastating being caught for corruption is. I mean, one could watch that and then come away with the conclusion that I just need to be sneakier. She worked for SARS, by the way, not Home Affairs. I just need to be sneakier in hiding my corruption. But I don't know. It does seem to me like it's kind of sending the right message by sort of highlighting cases where people, in fact, did face the law for breaking the law.
Yeah, I will lie if I say that it wasn't a little bit of a tough watch. So I'm somewhat conflicted. On the one hand, it's excellent to have a first-hand example, and to hear it in person, I think, has a different effect than knowing of somebody who did corruption somewhere else and you're not entirely sure what happened to them. So there's something quite vivid about it. On the other hand, I felt a little bit uncomfortable hearing it, but I think that's more of a personal issue than it is. It's perhaps more important to have these kind of examples as solutions to many of the issues that we face. I think also the thing that I take away from this is something that we at the Institute has been promoting for a long time, which is this idea of having a change of culture in the public service. And we've put particular emphasis on it because South Africa, the public service, has rules on paper. but those rules don't always control how people actually behave in practice. And the reason for that is that I think the public service hasn't quite institutionalized, in a sense. So it hasn't quite adopted those rules as culture in many of the public service departments. What I mean with that is that the public service hasn't quite developed a culture where the rules matter. The jobs have clear duties. The officials act professionally and not arrogantly. Let's add that there as well, because that's, I think, something that most people face on a regular basis, the arrogance from the public service side. I'd add to that list of not yet things that hasn't yet been adopted as culture in the public service, that wrongdoing is properly punished. I think so many people still actually get away with it. And the idea that public servants are here to serve the public and not the parties or the people who got them into the position, or their private interests. Public servants are there to serve the public. So I think what happened in place of many of these things becoming part of the culture, we've instead see a culture develop where the demands of political parties have stepped in, your personal connections, and in many cases, even criminal networks have kind of stepped in and have been able to work themselves into the culture of our public service. So, yeah, I think it is necessary to have these kind of stories to see that reorientation of the public service, and to enforce a culture of people wanting to rather obey the rules and adhere to the things that are set out that will help them to serve the public. So uncomfortable as it may have been to watch, I think it is necessary, and I think it's a unique way to approach this reorientation in culture. And I say unique in the sense that I think up until now, well, I haven't seen other videos like this. They might be out there, and I'd be happy to be corrected on this. But I think up until now, we see things like the Matlanga Commission, and we see other instances of court cases happening with people in public service who are being corrected and held accountable. But I think in smaller departments, up until now, it's been just talk. Many people are told, you're not supposed to be corrupt. Here are the rules. This is how you're supposed to act. But I think introducing this firsthand experience of people who were corrupt is a unique way to wake people up and to shake them up to the reality of being corrupt and the consequences of corrupt practices.
Yeah, you know, we talk a lot about policy and why policy needs to change, and that's true. That's a very important part of fixing the country. But I think some of these things like culture and stuff can be affected a lot more, actually, almost by campaigns like this, by leadership, by convincing people, not just through sort of the stick, but also the carrot, by showing people what to kind of aspire to. And when you have the top leadership of government departments, of the police, of all these institutions being found guilty of or being accused of or being tangled up in all sorts of corrupt webs, that really, I think, does poison the entire culture. So providing counterexamples of the consequences, but also showing that, you know, you can be a politician or a minister or an official who, you know, does their job well, is proud of their job, and doesn't steal money is actually just as important as some of those other changes, as punishing people and as changing the policies to make these things less likely. So, yeah, you know, this is all part of creating systemic change, and I think it's a good move by the minister here.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it is a good move. And I think one of the less obvious dots that can be connected here, but once it's pointed out, it'll be very obvious, is that the moment, so let's say three of us are sitting in the room, it's you, me, and this woman telling of her experience, I will perhaps be more moved and affected by it than you will, let's say more scared afterwards. And just the fact that I now want to adhere to these rules and rather not do the corrupt thing, I think from peer pressure, then you'll also perhaps see a change in the way that you operate. And in that way, I think the effect of peers in the workplace has a major influence on culture in the workplace.
And another name for culture really is just peer pressure.
Exactly.
That's really what we're trying to do. Exactly. Have positive peer pressure here. So instead of everyone being pressured to smoke weed behind the bike sheds, everyone's going to be pressured to get A's on their tests or whatever. Anyway, let's move on to our last one. And these were completely different clips. One is from DA MP Gladys Breitenbach talking about problems in the Justice Department and a court she was visiting. And the other is an SABC News story about a police station or a number of police stations in the Northern Cape. And just completely by coincidence, while we were sort of looking for stories, both of these popped up unrelated to each other, and they both involve failures of justice because of a lack of electricity.
People are expected to access justice is shocking. The conditions under which magistrates and prosecutors are expected to dispense justice inside this building is quite shocking. You've seen now for yourself, of course there's no electricity, and that's not the fault of anybody here. The cables were cut, and that's part of life in South Africa today. But nevertheless, it means that the entire court is in darkness. You see the people sitting here today, some of them have been here since 8 o'clock, they have not yet been helped. People take days, unpaid leave, days off work, get into trouble with their employers to come here. And then they find that their case can't go on because of the darkness. The whole thing is unsatisfactory. It isn't the fair dispensing of justice. None of us should be happy with the situation. The
police station makes crime fighting impossible at night. They say the situation prevents them from reaching the police when they need their intervention. Victims of crime say when they try to report crimes at night, they are told to return the next day. This has left the community frustrated.
We can't lay charges. We can't get help from the SAPS. The phone lines is off when there's no electricity at the building. We can't live like this in this community.
I want them to do changes. Yes, nobody's saving Richie. That's what I want. I want changes. If you're actually an old lady, when there's something going to happen, how are we going to reach them? There's nothing they can do because we can't find them. We phone. It's only ringing. Nothing's coming through.
Oh, Andre, it's stories like that that just kind of make you want to put your head in your hands because, this is the police not being able to do their job, the justice and the courts not being able to do their job because they don't have electricity. How do we fix this?
This is my only response, this. There is no better response than that. How on earth are these police officers and the magistrates in the courts, the justices, supposed to actually do their work if they do not have the most basic thing that an office needs, which is electricity? And I'm assuming, and it's an assumption, I'm putting it out there, it's an assumption, but it might just be because the bills have not been paid. I think in the case of the courts, Glynis mentioned that the lines were cut, so there might also be some lines that were stolen, and that might be the reason why it's not been repaired yet. Which is another major issue. The fact that those two people who are being interviewed by ENCA about the police station that does not, but about the police station that is does not have electricity, how infuriating that there's perhaps an emergency and there's nothing that the police or the community can do to get the police on the scene. If you just think of a simple example that there's a crime happening, the person knows the chances of him being caught is so little because the crime can only be reported the next day. What on earth would prevent him from actually doing the crime? And I immediately now see that comment from, I'm assuming, Carl Edwards, that says who suffers the most. And that's exactly the problem. Just earlier this week, we had an article about detectives and the shortage of detectives that we have in the country. I think you might have also had it on the show. I'm not entirely sure, Nicholas. But
no, we
see the number of detectives, trained detectives, halving from 2016. Those are the people who are supposed to connect the dots between the crime and the court case and actually holding criminals accountable. If we have a shortage of detectives, which we have, if I'm not mistaken, it's almost 6,000 positions that were budgeted for that are not full. Those shortages directly negatively affect and predominantly negatively affect the poorer communities. We see that the private security has increased by something like 400% in the, I'm not entirely sure about the time frame on that. But the people who can afford it, those are the people who are making use of those services. It's the people who can't afford them that are predominantly negatively affected by the lack of services in these communities. So it is infuriating that we have police stations where people can't get a hold of the police officers. And I would not be surprised if there's not enough vehicles, if there's not enough computers working, if there's not enough detectives in those police stations. As far as the courts go, I think that is a major issue. There's also security concerns, of course, related to many of these court situations. I genuinely am. If I say I'm frustrated, I can't even imagine how frustrated these communities are. But it genuinely is a massive issue. As far as it goes for fixing it, I think many of the solutions that we suggest for the public service is applicable here. But getting these stations to work, paying the bills on time, making sure that if there is, and this is more a municipal issue, but making sure that if cables are stolen, firstly, obviously, you would like to track down the people who stole them, but also replacing them. It's important that municipalities have a system in place to replace infrastructure that is stolen and damaged and to maintain that infrastructure. So, yeah, massive issue and incredibly damaging to communities.
Yeah, I think you know, the sort of answers aren't super sexy on this one. You can like link it back to our previous one, right? When you talk about changing kind of departmental culture, the sort of a culture that officials have to say there's accountability. When you don't do your job, you get fired. And this is, you know, it's a simple thing. It's a difficult thing because of how tough our labor legislation makes it to fire people. But even with our tough labor legislation, managers still don't follow the rules. And that's actually a really important part here. People who don't do their work should be fired. Also, of course, this ties back to our value for money propositions that, some of these areas or some of these departments, you might ask them, well, why aren't you replacing this? And they'll say, no, we have a system to replace it, whatever, to get the electricity, but we just don't have budget. Well, why don't they have budget? They don't have budget because constantly money is spent on inflated BEE tenders, on paying to corrupt cronies, on that sort of thing, which means that the government doesn't get its proper value for money. And what's the end result? The end result is that poor people can't go and register a crime when they get attacked in the middle of the night. So yes. It's not, over and over again, it's not that there isn't enough money in South Africa. It's that we spend it so badly that we don't see the returns we should be getting from our tax money.
Yeah. One of the things that Linus also pointed out in the second half of the video, which we did not play now, is that there is enough money being allocated to these, to what needs to happen, but that the power of allocation is sitting in the wrong hands. I think she mentioned that the Department of Justice is supposed to give enough funds so that the courts can obviously pay all their bills and have everything that they need. And the amount of money, there's incentive for the Department of Justice and the corrupt officials at the top of it, or in the, let's say, in the lines of authority of it, to not equip these courts and the MPA with the necessary funds, because then they can't do their work and they can't fulfill their mandate. So, yeah, it also draws back directly to appointing people not in terms of your friends, not having people in positions of power that are placed there because they are comrade or because they they have a good relationship with you. So having people appointed based on merit and according to their abilities.
Yeah, exactly right. Okay, well, that is all the time we have for today. We hope they found the show interesting. I'm now going to go and drown my sorrows, and I rather hope that South Africa does at least eke out one win this World Cup. I think Mexico are argued by some to be the strongest team that we're going to face. So, you know, maybe we'll be lucky and actually see ourselves winning a World Cup game. That would be very nice. South Africa seems to sort of lurch between moments of sporting triumph, and then we go into these depressing periods where everyone is really angry with each other, and then, you know, something good happens and we feel good for 10 minutes. I could really do with a pick-me-up right now, so I'd quite like that. Anyway, I hope you all have a wonderful weekend. We will be back next week on the Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone. Have a great one. Bye-bye.